Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program Alice Van Buren. She's writer and producer of the new film, Ink, A Tale of Captivity, which is screening tonight at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a film set in 1675. It's the tale of Mary Rowlandson. Who was she?
She was a minister's wife who was captured by Indians during King Philip's War, which is a war that they don't teach in the schools. It was basically the first very large-scale massacre. Not the first, but the first, there was a Pequot massacre. This was the next big massacre in New England that set the pattern for all Western conquest of the native tribes.
Who massacred whom?
The Puritans, who were basically English people, massacred the Massachusetts and Rhode Island tribes.
And it was a story in which, I mean, a great deal of bloodshed and also captivity of people like Mary Rowlandson
mm-hmm.
and her children.
Yes, and Mary was exceptional because she was literate, which was rare for a woman in those days, and she wrote a report that is one of the most readable things from the period. A lot of men wrote, too, about King Philip's War, but their writing tended to be so drenched in Puritan ideology that it's almost unreadable.
Really?
And she actually wrote a fairly vivid account. There's a certain amount of Puritan ranting and biblical Bible thumping, but in between the Bible thumping, you can hear a woman's voice.
And what's that account like?
Well, it's a very sparsely but vividly written story of what happened to her for those 3 or 4 months that she was with the Indians in the dead of winter. You get a vivid picture of how hungry she was. There was nothing to eat. They were all starving. And she eventually made her way in the tribe by making clothes for people. And that way she gained a certain amount of status and respect, and she eventually got to meet King Philip, who was the English name for the leader of the rebellion. And she's the only person behind enemy lines who actually met King Philip once he had gone on the warpath.
So King Philip was the name of the Indian.
Well, his name was Metacom.
Right.
But the English called him King Philip.
Why did they call him that?
They called him that and his brother Alexander after the pagan kings of Macedonia. They wanted to give them, whether in mockery or seriousness, who knows, they couldn't give them Christian names, so these were noble savages, or names for pagans.
So how did she, in real life, how did she get out and get back to her family?
She was ransomed back, as were her children. It's quite remarkable that everybody made it home, but they did. Now, in my story, I don't have the children.
Right.
I had too much plot to cope with, and the children barely appear in her narrative, and I thought I'm making her a slightly more contemporary woman than she was, and I thought she would be more interesting as a woman without children. That's my bias.
So how did you come across this story, and what got you working on it? I mean, first it was a play, right?
Mm-hmm. It began as a play. Actually, it began as a novel, and then it became a play, and then it became a film. I was in Rhode Island in my 30s. I was running away from a divorce, and I ended up in Providence. And I wondered, why is everything called King Philip's Plaza, King Philip's Car Wash, Metacomet Boulevard? Who was this person? And so I started reading about King Philip's War, and I was absolutely shocked to see that it was all news to me. So, and then in reading about this war, I ran across Mary Rowlandson's story and found it so interesting, and it's haunted me ever since.
And so you have made a film in which, I have to say, I mean, reading just a little bit on the internet about her story and then seeing your film, you've definitely taken some artistic and interpretive license.
Indeed. Yes, I've made up a story about a coat that she makes for the King Philip's son. That's my invention. Her relationship with the Indian who takes care of her, James Printer, is not made up. I don't think it was made up. He was actually there at her captivity, and he was trained to set type at Harvard College. He'd been trained to do so to set type on an Indian Bible that was printed in the phonetic language, and he was known to be present at her captivity. He's even mentioned once in her narrative, and ironically, he's the man who set the type on her story, so they knew each other.
Right, but in the film, they have a relationship, and he teaches her to sing Indian songs and things like that.
That's my take.
Right. Now, I mean, what was interesting to me was, I mean, you have the, I guess what you might call a Puritan account of evil savages, And then you have your account in which she actually kind of likes them, and they kind of, the guy kind of likes her. And I wonder, I mean, is that kind of a 21st century take on it, or was there any evidence in her narrative to inspire the relationship that you wrote in the movie?
I think there is, almost by reading between the lines and seeing what she didn't say, she never said anything very violent or vicious about King Philip. She can't quite so far as to say that he treated her well, but if you see what she actually reports, he treated her very well. So the premise of the film also is that she was obliged to write this way when she came home. Can you imagine if somebody went and spent time with Osama bin Laden and came back and said, oh boy, he's really a cool guy, he's really fun to talk to, he was really nice to me? Nobody would print that.
And I learned his songs.
Yeah, right.
And I learned to heal. And
right. I mean, that's completely anathema. So she had to tell the kind of story that she told.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things that's amazing about your film is that just the extraordinary hatred of both women and Indians.
It's profound. It's unbelievable, yeah. I mean, when you read the language, that's how they wrote about women and Native Americans.
I mean, I can see, well, I mean, it's hard to reconcile that with the kind of religious freedom Christian line that we're taught in school. I mean, these people were mean.
Yeah, they were pretty mean. If you disagree with them, well, look what they did. You know, they cut off Quakers' ears and noses. They sent, what was her name? Anne Hutchinson was exiled into the wilderness because she dared to speak up for herself and said that she had a direct relationship with God, and only the ministers were allowed to have a direct relationship with God. So
yeah, they were burning witches every 15 minutes.
Yeah, more or less. And this story is the prelude to that. I think one often in American history classes, you're taught, you learn about the landing and you learn about the pilgrims, and then the next thing you know, you're at the Salem witch trials, and how did the culture get from one place to the other? That's what we don't hear about.
And so one of the people in the, two of the people in the movie are Cotton Mather and his father, Increase, was his name?
Increase Mather.
Increase,
yes.
Mather.
Yes, yes.
Who do not come off very nicely.
No, I think the Cotton Mather is actually fairly humorous in a kind of dark way.
Right. Are they based pretty closely on historical fact, or did you take a license with them as well?
Well, I read a lot of their writing, so I think their language, I think, is somewhat faithful to the way they spoke and thought. And I have to say, in some respects, they were more enlightened than they appear. They were both crusaders for vaccinations, and they had fairly progressive ideas about medicine for their time.
At the same time, they were
Indian-hating preachers, but they all were, with very rare exceptions. And also, they were absolutely terrified of the Indians, and the Indians were probably, once they realized what was being done to them and how much they'd lost and how many treaties had been broken, they were probably a pretty fearsome bunch of antagonists.
So the film is called Ink, A Tale of Captivity. So in the film, Mary Rowlandson writes her story, but she writes it really the way her husband wants her to write it, who's also a preacher and who's also in that Puritan model, maybe not quite as heavy-duty as some of his contemporaries, but still, one gets the sense that if she were to write it the way she would have wanted, she would have been burned as a witch.
Possibly, yeah. She probably felt she didn't even have that latitude.
Yeah.
There's a chorus of busybodies who gossip all the way through the film, and they give you an idea of the power of gossip.
Right. And this is the thing that I was thinking about. I mean, what we have from that period, or indeed any historical period, pre-movies and all of that, is written accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And so written accounts were written by somebody with all sorts of social constraints.
Mm-hmm.
But what do we know about busybodies?
Well, that's what's fun. I mean, I had more freedom with the busybodies than anybody because they were completely made up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just like, I guess, the universal archetype of busybodies.
Right, right.
The film stars a lot of the best actors in Santa Fe. Angela Yanda plays Mary Rowlandson, and Wes Studi plays King Philip, and Jonathan Richards is in it, and Charles Gamble and Ryan Cochevar, and many more. How did you assemble this group and get them into this, what is presumably small-budget independent film?
Yes. Well, that was the most fun part about it, was actually rounding up the actors and working with the actors. I had a lot of help from Theater Grotesco, from Scott Harrison, from people who really know the theater community very deeply. And John Flax at Grotesco was quite familiar with this play because I'd read it with his people. And so I asked him, you know, their people's advice. And we had auditions, and it wasn't very hard to cast. Everybody just fell into place.
Yeah. Where did you film it? I mean, obviously, there must have been some New England.
Well, yes, we went back east just to get some nature shots and to get some architecture and some houses and some really wonderful mill works. There's an iron mill in the middle of the film that's really quite spectacular. That's in Saugus, Massachusetts. But everything else is in New Mexico. We shot the wilderness scenes up in the Chickarella Apache Reservation up in Dulce, which looks sort of like southern New Hampshire because of all those pine trees and that granite kind of rock.
Right.
And then we filmed some other outdoor scenes on ranches in Ojo Caliente and in Pecos and hope that people wouldn't know too much about trees and see that they're cottonwoods. And then we shot a scene of Harvard, the publishing party at Harvard, against the organ at the St. Francis Auditorium because it's very Tudor-looking.
I knew it.
Yeah.
I recognized that organ, right.
And then we shot another scene in the Zagwan House, which is a little bit stretching it, but it's fairly, the lines are very clean, and so it might look like a sort of a well-to-do, more modern sort of house of the period. And then we built sets at our place. We built the Mather Study off of pictures of what's presumed to be the Mather Study. And we built a real 17th century printing press that actually works, almost works, but it looks like it works.
Right. Oh, that's another question that I was going to have. Is that a real printing press?
Well, we studied the model. It was called the Common Press. Yeah. And my husband's a sculptor and a very handy guy and a Yankee through and through. And everybody, I have to say, who worked on this film, a lot of us come from New England, so the story was in our blood.
Right. Well, that whole Puritan, I mean, I guess you wrote it as close as possible to 17th century language.
No. 17th century, well, yes and no. The 17th century language was much more ornate. I read The Crucible a number of times because that's such a fine example of using a kind of archaic speech but a modern diction pattern.
Yeah.
So I tried to make it sound archaic, but also I've tried to make it fit the modern ear.
Right, so that we're not alienated from it when we're watching it.
It would be very off-putting.
And, of course, it's hard. You know, you get the accents as close as possible, but we don't even really know what they were.
We don't know what they were, yeah.
Yeah. We're talking to Alice Van Buren about the film Ink, A Tale of Captivity, which is screening tonight at the CCA. Let's talk about the play on which this film is based. Did you produce that, and has it been shown and so on?
I have had it read any number of places in around this country, and it's going actually to have a stage premiere in New England at Bangor, Maine, at the Penobscot Theater on March 30th this spring, and then a couple of weeks later it's going to a festival in London where it's going to be read, a play reading festival by the North American Actors Association. So I have real hopes that the play, I know that the play has legs. The weakness of the film is that we only had $100,000 to make it, and that's one of these, you know, it can't be done kind of thing. How can you possibly make a period film on so little money? Well, we just had to make it, so we just made it any way we could.
With independent films, I mean, there are a few moments where it's clear that this is a low-budget device, you're doing the best you can, it's okay, but you give them a pass because it's a locally produced independent film.
Right, right. But I hope that maybe somebody will pick it up who's really got some bucks and could do full justice to the story, maintaining my script, not turning it into a Christian Wright kind of heroine, which there's been some talk about doing in the movie world.
Or a Hollywood...
Right. Right. But clearly the film would have benefited from $1 million just to have battle scenes and to make those Indians look like they really look like. Mine are very tame looking. I mean, Wes and Alan and the others who all helped so much with this film were great, but they would have been better if they'd had shaved heads and mohawks and were bare-chested and painted and were, you know, really made to look like the way they were at the time.
Yeah, I mean, then there's this... I mean, what the Puritans and indeed what the Americans did to the Native Americans of this country, did to the Indians of this continent, is so savage that all the accusations of savagery, of Indian savagery, are ridiculous. At the same time, there was a lot of brutality on both sides.
It absolutely
and
was.
To be able to show that in a film and to be able to do it in a historically accurate way would be interesting.
It would be formidable, yeah. And PBS has made some noble efforts, which is not always appreciated by Native Americans. Native Americans back east are very critical of what PBS has done. And I wish that we could do even half of what PBS had done.
Yeah.
However, I think there's a kind of poetic irony on showing this film today on Columbus Day, because it's a day where we might well contemplate our origins and, you know, our nation's original sins.
Now, are you New England many generations back?
Some part of my family is, yeah.
Yeah. So when you say it's in your blood, you're not kidding.
Well, I think it's in all our blood. I mean, everyone who came here to some degree at the expense of Native Americans. We're all living on their land. You know what I mean? Every generation, every inch of this country was taken from them.
Right. But I suppose, I don't know. Personally, I don't feel it. So I don't feel it in the same way because my parents came here in the 20th century. So.
Right.
What do you think, when you look at it, I was thinking as I was watching the film, what do you think is the legacy of that Puritan culture that lives with us today, that's expressed today?
That's a great question. The play came to me, this had been basically fiction until 2003, and then in 2003 there was a Republican landslide in Congress, and I started hearing these Puritan voices that sounded so much like the voices of our politicians, of our Republican politicians, who have an incredibly sense of entitlement to the American way of life, or the God-givenness of this. And I thought, my God, this is a pattern of thinking that goes back to our roots.
Very interesting. The film is called Ink, A Tale of Captivity, and it's screening tonight at the CCA at 7 o'clock. Alice Van Buren is the writer and producer of this film. And so, is it going to be screening? I mean, do you have distribution at this point of some kind?
No, we have no distribution yet. We have a screening, another screening scheduled in Albuquerque at a conference in February about captivity narratives, which will be very interesting to show it to a more academically minded group of scholars who really know, who will know what I made up.
So anthropologists who study captivity narratives?
Yeah, or historians or literary historians, yeah.
Very interesting. That would be a reading project all of its own, is reading captivity narratives.
Oh, it's taught. Mary Rowlandson is the first thing that turns up on every reading list on that subject, and she's the mother of American writers, of American women writers. She's the first who was published. So, yeah, she's pretty well known in academic circles.
So there are college classes called captivity narratives?
I think there are, yes.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well, Alice Van Buren, we'll see you tonight at the CCA here in Santa Fe. The phone number there is 982-1338 and ccasantafe.org. Is there a website for your film?
Yes, it's Inkatale, I-N-K-A-T-A-L-E, Inkatale.com.
Inkatale.com.
Right.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Frederica Johnson and Aaron O'Shaughnessy. Frederica is the director and Aaron, one of the lead actors in the play Two Rooms, which just opened this weekend at Warehouse 21. And it's going on this coming weekend, October 14th, 15th, and 16th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us on.
So what's this play about?
Well, the play is about my husband is a hostage in Beirut. And we were teaching there. He was taken as a hostage. I am in America trying to get him back. And I'm dealing with a government worker and a reporter who would like to break this big story that the government's not doing all that they should be doing to get this poor man out of the situation.
What year is it taking place?
It takes place it was written in the 80s. And it takes place in the 80s. And why this was chosen is because if you go and you watch it, I do think people will leave not really knowing what year it is, because unfortunately it can happen today.
And hostage situations are not unique to any one time in history.
Correct. So that's a big part of why we chose it.
And so this play stars you and Matt Sanford. Mm-hmm. And are you the only two actors in the play?
No, we're the husband and wife in it. There's Tove Scher. She plays the government worker. and Matthew Joseph Pewitt. He plays Walker, the reporter, in it. So there's just four of us.
So what's it like to direct this play? What's, I mean, it must be primarily psychological.
It is, and it's been a wonderful experience because it's a very tight ensemble. Everyone's been very professional and also very fun to work with on a serious subject. And we've actually had a really good time working together. And we rehearsed only just a month, and they are on it. And I feel so good about this show, and I am very proud of these performers. They're all very hardworking, and everybody has jobs, daytime jobs, and we manage at night to have pulled this together. And so it will be at Warehouse 21, and the night shows are at 7, just to let everybody know, and the two matinees are at 2.
Right.
And it's very emotional for anybody watching, I think. You kind of don't move.
Talk about the playwright Lee Blessing. This is someone, not that I'm an aficionado of theater and I don't know everything, but this is a playwright I haven't heard of.
And I hadn't either, which is embarrassing, because he wrote something called A Walk in the Woods, which is actually quite well known. But I hadn't heard of him either, and I've been in theater all my life, so I was very embarrassed. I didn't know.
So how did you come across the play?
Well, I didn't. Aaron found it and brought it to me.
How did you come across the play?
I came across a wonderful acting teacher had seen it. It first went up at La Jolla Playhouse in California in 1988, and she had seen this, my acting teacher. And so it's a piece that has been dear to her, and so she had shared it with all of her students, and we had kind of ripped it apart, and so it was one of my plays on my list of wanting to always do, and a story I always wanted to tell. This is my first time producing anything, so it seemed it all kind of fell into place. It's a four-person cast, not a lot of set, everything's around a rug, you know. So for my first time, I thought I don't have the money or and the time to
have special
do that
effects.
Right, exactly. The money went into lights, you know. That's lights, and it's the acting, and the story tells everything, I think.
Now, Frederica, you have been in the theater scene around here for a long time.
Very long.
And have directed dozens and dozens of plays.
Yes, it's added up to around 68. And I've done 68 bits of work here, and I didn't direct all 68, but most of them.
And we haven't seen you for a while? Or have you been out of...
Well, I was the drama teacher up at Santa Fe Prep, and then I retired and did a couple of shows after that. I did Rumors at the Playhouse and the Santa Fe Playhouse, and then I did Zoo Story to raise money for Warehouse 21, and then I realized I retired to stop for a while and to write a novel, just to see what that's like, even though I might be the only one that ever reads it, but I could be. So then Aaron walked into my life. Aaron and her husband, Elias Gallegos, they came to my house, and I just said, well, these are two of the most wonderful people, and whatever they want to do, I'll just trail around.
No, not right off the bat. Right when we met her, she said, I'm here for advice. I'm not directing anything. I'm not getting back into it, just so you know. We said, okay, and we sat down, and I explained, you know, I've seen the theater here, and I would love to add to it. I know Scott Harrison with Ironweed does an amazing job, but he does one show a year, and my complaint is we need more, you know? And so I thought, I want to start something that falls in those footsteps, start maybe once a year, and do it really well and really good. And within 2 minutes, Freddie said, okay, I'm directing it. Whatever it is, I'll do it.
Didn't take much.
It didn't take much to get me out of the mothballs.
Right. Well, I would think, I mean, we had a Michael McGarity on the air the other day, and he's a wonderful mystery writer. And I was asking him after we finished, how do you bear the solitude? And he says, I like the solitude. Whereas I think theater people, they like to be around other people. So writing a novel must be a challenge.
Oh, yes, it is. And I haven't minded the solitude. It's kind of, you meet yourself coming and going in it, and you learn so much more about yourself when you put yourself there. And you also appreciate all the writers in the world who have to go through that. But then I guess I was just waiting for Aaron. And there she came.
So, Erin O'Shaughnessy, what's your own background?
I come from, I was just in Los Angeles for 15 years. My background is primarily TV and film. My husband and I moved here thinking we're just going to give it a year try. My husband is born and raised here in Santa Fe.
Ah.
And so we came here, and then he actually went out for Face of Fox, this big competition, and got it and got this contract with Face of Fox. So then I sat here looking in the mirror thinking, now, I guess that takes away going back to L.A. And lo and behold, I actually booked a movie right before coming up with this show and just filmed a lead role. It's called Roswell FM with Brendan Fair and Jason London. We wrapped that, and then I came back from Roswell and started in production with Two Rooms. So
when does that film come out?
The film will come out next summer, 2012.
And is it a Hollywood film?
It is a Hollywood film. Stephen Griffin is a new first-time feature director. Anyways, uh-huh. He was wonderful. And
So raising the level of Santa Fe Theater.
I would like to.
Yeah. Not that it's all,
No. I think that everybody, they work on these one shows, and these are brilliant shows, and I guess I want to add to that. And for me, what I found, right when I got here, my husband and I ran and auditioned for Benchwarmers, because we just wanted to get on stage immediately. And there were a lot of people, I think 70% of us were newcomers to Santa Fe, and so I met a lot of new actors, and we all kind of said, we need a home for us all. I do feel like it's a closed circuit. I kept looking for auditions. I theater work and Ironweed, and nothing's published.
So everybody's got their own actors who they are.
Have
already pre-cast.
Right, pulled up from their pool, and so all of us were talking backstage, saying, "Well, how do we get noticed?" And the answer to me was, I guess, produce my own show and force these people to come watch me to get involved.
So you're producing and acting.
Yes.
That's a lot of work.
It is a ton of work. And thank goodness Freddie has taken me under her wing to teach me all that she knows.
We've been co-producing together.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Erin is the honcho.
I don't know.
So are you starting a company?
Yes, Thirsty Brush Productions.
Thirsty Brush Productions.
Thirsty Brush Productions. Is
that like a paintbrush metaphor?
It is a paintbrush metaphor. My husband is an artist as well as an actor, and now I guess Fox host. But he would paint, and it would be you would dip that paintbrush into the paint, and you'd start to paint. And when it runs out, it creates that effect of not enough paint. And so in our minds, it is a fancy way of saying starving artists or starving actors that are creating our own work. We're creating our own paint.
And and perhaps the town is thirsty for what you do.
I hope so. We'll see.
So the play is called Two Rooms, and you're playing opposite Matt Sanford,
yes.
who's from Santa Fe.
From Santa Fe, and we find out just about a month ago that he is distant cousins of my husband.
Is that right?
They all grew up on Pacheco Street.
It is a very small town.
It is.
Ladies and gentlemen. And a fine actor doing a wide variety of work over the years.
Oh, my gosh. He was just in the melodrama as the villain. He did he was Dracula in the play that he wrote. I mean, he is the busiest man in Santa Fe. I'm so lucky. We are so lucky to have him.
He's also a technical wizard.
Ah, that helps. In small productions.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we kind of couldn't do it without him.
So a play by Lee Blessing is called Two Rooms, directed by Frederica Johnson, starring Erin O'Shaughnessy, who joins us. The two of them join us here, plus Matt Sanford and a couple of others. Warehouse 21, this Friday and Saturday at 7 o'clock. And then Sunday at 2 o'clock, for reservations, you can call 672-8799 or just show up at Warehouse 21, and it's the upstairs theater.
Upstairs theater, there's elevator access.
Excellent. Well, thank you both so much for being with us on Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Neil Egan and Andrew Tree. They are from Boys to Men Mentoring. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary.
So Boys to Men Mentoring, initiation rituals, is that the kind of thing that you do, or what's it all about?
Initiation ritual isn't not quite the right word I would use, partly because culturally we don't really support full initiation rituals and content, but it's the basis of what we do. We attempt to celebrate and mark the transition of boys into manhood, and the teenage years are that transitional time when they're moving into themselves in a different way. So initiation in that respect. So ritual and markers to celebrate and identify the fact that something important is happening in these young men's lives.
What ages of young men are you, or boys or young men are you working with?
We find that boys are not ready for this sort of experience until they're at least 13. Ideally, we would always choose a boy when he's ready, or more likely when he knows he's ready, or probably even more likely his mother knows he's ready. As it is, we find we have boys coming to us between the ages of about 13 and 17.
And how do you find them, and what are the needs that they're coming with?
Oftentimes it's the parents or older people around them that identify this idea that things are changing in their relationships with their young, with their sons, and an understanding that they would appreciate some help because the son is starting to separate from the parents in certain ways, wanting more independence, more decision making, and often that creates conflict in the house. Often the young people are having difficulties at school, not necessarily anything dramatic, but they're just starting to have more difficulties in their personal relationships. So when they hear that there's an opportunity for these young men to get some assistance and guidance and support, they reach out to us. In addition, we, as a group, try to make our presence known. This is a wonderful opportunity. Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for our opportunity to let people know that we're available so the conversations can go on within the community. And most people understand that the young men and women need mentoring, guidance, support outside the family structure as they mature into teenage years.
I think our experience is that if young people, and whereas we focus on boys, I'm sure it is true for young women as well, if they're not given suitable transitory experiences, developmental ones, they will go looking for them. And our experience is that boys in particular, who are looking for perhaps some risk, adventure and challenge, if that is not channeled in a good and healthy way, maybe we'll bring it into their lives in ways which is less helpful and have quite significant consequences for them.
Like gangs.
Like gangs.
So, I mean, I think girls and boys are going through similar challenges in some ways, but hormonally they're going in kind of opposite ways. I mean, they differentiate a lot during those years, and boys suddenly get really big and really strong very quickly and have all this energy that they don't know what to do with, especially, I mean, I'm just horrified beyond imagination how little physical education there is in the schools at this point. Yet there's athletic teams, but if you're not doing that, I mean, the kids in school don't seem to really be given an outlet for that energy.
I agree, and the change in the schools that lack of physical activity, that sedentary direction that the schools appear to me to be more concerned with containing energy than they did when I was younger. There seemed to be more space. There were recess and breaks, and everybody took gym, so they had a chance to move around. And then that's problematic for the boys, particularly to be still that long or to be that contained or to be that... They do benefit from a lot of energetic activity. So the schools have become, in my opinion, a little less of the vehicle for the kind of transition and support and guidance. There are certain ways that they are no longer as helpful or as strong as they were when I was younger, in my opinion.
And there's also a problem, I think, that in an era where everybody's worried about terrorism and so on, the laws have gotten so much stronger and more stringent, and that has trickled down to the school systems. And so I mean, it's not only about containment, but it's about really tough rules. I mean, in my day, which now seems like a long time ago, you break a rule and you get slapped on the wrist. And now, I mean, you can go to reform school or whatever it's called now, or even go to prison for things like drinking. I mean, not that I'm advocating underage drinking, but ladies and gentlemen, it's not, it isn't not going to happen. So how do you deal with it?
So some of the rules can certainly seem very punitive. But going back to the opportunities for activity, I've read research, I've seen a lot of research done around the environment in which boys learn best, and certainly that would appear to be environments in which they can be extremely active. And certainly some of our ongoing mentoring program, which is what we offer in addition to the specific weekend rites of passage, includes getting out and being active. For example, this Sunday we'll be heading up probably up into the Aspens to hike up there. But this is part of the ongoing program we have with the boys.
So tell us more about the actual mentoring that you guys do.
The introduction to our program generally comes with a weekend. We invite the young men to come and spend a weekend with us, and we introduce the journey that we're offering to share with them. Andrew spoke a couple of minutes ago about the idea that young men are on what I call the hero's journey. It's this transition from boyhood to manhood. The hero's journey is played out in the vast majority of the movies and stories about, it's always about the young knight that separates from his home or the comfort zone and goes on the adventure. Well, we try to introduce and celebrate that adventure that every boy goes on in order to find himself. And often in the stories, that means marrying the princess. That's the reward. That's the welcome
right.
home. That's the return, you know. And marrying the princess is symbolic for finding themselves and recognizing who they are. And so we start with the weekend, and then invite the young men to spend 3 or 4 hours with us every other Sunday afternoon. In the case of Santa Fe, Sunday afternoon turned out to be the most amenable time for the most people. And it's an ongoing checking in and opportunity to deepen the relationships, to give the young men opportunities to talk about what's going on with them in their lives, and primarily for the mentors to create this environment where maybe we can be supportive. Our job is to support, admire, mentor these young men. Not punish, not lecture, not, you know, we have a little different relationship than some of the other figures in their lives, and create this space where they're allowed to experiment and expand a little more into who they are and question what's going on in the world.
So, yeah, as a follow-up to the Rites of Passage weekend, there's always a danger in offering a powerful experience like that, that if it's not supported afterwards, that they can go back to where they were before, if you like. So these twice monthly meetings are there to support them and to deepen the relationships between the mentors and these boys, to develop the relationship of trust, so they actually have other men in their lives where they may lack men as role models outside the family, who they can trust and talk to about some of the challenges of being teenage boys, which can include some of the things we've touched on already, but it clearly can be gangs, and it can be substances and relationships with sexual relationships. They can develop those relationships in a way that they know they can talk about these things in a group setting, and it will be held confidential, and they'll be treated with respect in that setting.
Do you find that a lot of the boys who come to you are people who don't have father figures or strong males in their life?
Yes, we do. Our idea of our program is that this would be a beneficial and helpful environment for any young man. And in fact, often single parent homes and boys who are starting to have conflict in the schools, getting difficulties with the authorities at school and things like that, are more look to us more quickly. So we do not want or think that our program should be identified as boys at risk. All boys are at risk in the sense that the teenage travels. Andrew spoke to that a little bit, the adventure of being a teenager, that hero's journey. Young men seek risk and challenge, and they will go to the edge, whether it's with some of the things Andrew mentioned or driving fast cars.
Right.
Staying out late at night and hanging out in the mall when they might find conflict with other individuals. They'll seek dangerous places, so they go to the edge of themselves.
So what kind of edge do you provide in your activities? Like physical stuff?
Physical challenges are part of it, but not the basic function. The edges that we provide have more to do with these young men bumping into places where they're uncomfortable sharing, where they're uncomfortable exploring their issues of trust, of their ability to tell the truth out loud to people they don't know very well.
But that sounds like sitting, if I may say so, sitting around the campfire or something, whereas, I thought you were going to be, out doing bows and arrows or, ropes courses or something like that. I mean, how do you help them get their energy out?
There are a lot of sort of outbound opportunities for boys, for young people, to specifically do those sort of activities. And I think we do as much of that as we can. I say, actually, hiking this weekend, we do some backpacking, we do other outdoor activities. Some of the challenges are that we have to be so safe in this day and age. I love the idea that if we were really going to the edge, unfortunately, I don't think our society supports us taking teenagers who are not adults and therefore not able to take responsibility for themselves. We have that responsibility. Society doesn't support us actually taking them to a place where there is a serious risk of something happening.
Right.
So we do have to play safer than perhaps we would like to do.
Now, the work that you're doing is based to some extent on the work of Robert Bly and some of the people who really in the 80s initiated this kind of, what would you call it, men's movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of the more recent foundation of the ideas that we're involved with are Joseph Campbell, Carl Jung, with his idea of archetypes consciousness that we share. In other words, the idea of community, culture, being broader and something that we are as a human beings, that we all belong to a certain group and share something because of that. And then Joseph Campbell, Robert Bly, Michael Mead, and a man named Maladoma Somme, who was part of the last initiation of his tribe in Africa. And that part of his...
The last?
The last. That was the last initiation of his
Why
tribe.
Did they stop?
Modern world entered,
oh,
and the young men were leaving the village. Historically, we lived in smaller communities. We lived in tribes and villages, and everybody had a job, had a purpose, had a training into their contribution to the community in the village. And the initiation experience was part of that, preparing young people to step into their roles as adults. In the modern world, we don't have that. We're scattered. Families are spread out. People have moved around. Technology, automobiles, all of the things that have sped up the world and spread out our consciousness around that. We no longer have these smaller units. And so one of the ideas of Boys to Men is to attempt to reintroduce that into our culture, this idea that we are a community. These young men have responsibilities, and they need guidance and support and information about how to be a responsible man. And so initiatory in that respect, trying to introduce this idea of the development into manhood and your purpose here on the planet. Why are you here?
Right.
How do you how do we help you get to that place where you're authentic?
So how long have you been doing it? Have you seen these boys go from 13 and now they're 25 years old and they've kind of made it? Or are you still in an earlier stage of that?
The project in New Mexico has just been going for a couple of years. It started, the Boys to Men project started in California, I'm thinking, is it 10 to 15 years ago now? So certainly those men there running that project have seen exactly that. They've seen that, taken the boys as 12, 13-year-olds and seen them right through into adulthood.
And they've followed up with them and everything?
Oh, yes.
So
and,
it works?
It works. In some communities more, we haven't reached that stage yet. Some of the communities in Canada and in other states in the U.S. have certainly looked and produced the evidence around the impact of the program on boys, around attendance, around graduation specifically, because those are the most direct and immediate ones if you're looking for really meaningful, grounded criteria of success, if you like.
So when you have boys who come into this program and maybe they've got problems with authority, presumably they're going to kind of act those out on you guys.
That's a possibility, but, you know, in fact, my experience is that all boys are good boys, and they have challenges, they have difficulties, and we provide the opportunity for them to experiment with not being violent, not being adversarial, and it's a very unusual for us to experience that. Their goal is to provide a safe environment for them to explore who they are. That can include some anger, but it's not common, and
yeah.
It's very uncommon for us to actually have conflict with any of our young men.
And at least part of this comes because we create a very strong container. When the boys step into the weekend, which for most of them will be their first experience of the Boys to Men mentoring program, they will find themselves in an environment which there are more staff men, more adult men than there are boys, sometimes by a proportion
two
of...
2 to 1?
Yes, can be 2 to 1, plus the support we have of the boys who've already been through the program. So other teenage boys who are kind of very much with us as part of this container. And in there, and if a young man is needing to express himself, whatever that is, that can be very well held in that sort of container.
So we're just about out of time, but how do people find out more about this? If they want to participate, or if they've got sons or cousins or friends who might be candidates for this?
Thank you for that opportunity, because one thing we want people to know is that there's a place for participation by everybody. Support from the women who think that this is important. Financial support is always appreciated. The website is boystomennewmexico.org, all spelled out.
Boystomennewmexico.org, and you can Google that too, and it'll come right up.
Yes, and as long as you, that's why I emphasize sometimes the word mentoring. As I spoke to you, the musical group Boys to Men gobbles up a lot of Google space.
Yeah, mentoring.
So when we say Boys to Men Mentoring or Boys to Men New Mexico, you'll find us.
Yeah.
And the website makes it available for you to all the contact information, places where you can indicate the interest that you have. People from schools, Andrew and I are available to talk to many people from public civic organization, schools, churches, all of that.
And by the way, there is actually a weekend event coming up.
Yes, our next Rites of Passage weekend, or what we call Rites of Passage Adventure for the teenage boys, starts a week today, Friday the 14th of October, and runs to the Sunday afternoon. So it's from Friday evening through till Sunday afternoon.
And the telephone number also for more information is 470-5960, 470-5960.
That's correct.
Andrew Tree and Neil Egan are with Boys to Men Mentoring of New Mexico. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.